I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome again to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, anti-electoralist, and a lot more. If we are against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. This series explores what a free society might hopefully look like one day, while recognizing that today, none of us are truly free. And as ever, WXRW, River West Radio needs your help. Times are tough for nonprofits like us, and especially so for those who seek to engage, educate, and activate the young and the disenfranchised. If you want to help us out, donate today online or join our Patreon campaign or come into the station at 824 East Center Street and purchase some gear. Or if you represent a local entity of some kind, business or otherwise, reach out and become an official underwriter. You can support us, and in so doing, we will make sure that everyone knows about you. All right, last week was pretty tough, and I'm happy to say that I am feeling much, much better. Some dear friends expressed concern about me, and let me say, thank you so much, Sandy and Zav, for your kindness and your well wishes. You know, just the fact that some people are listening really helps me to feel a little less alone in this project. And don't worry, I've got some irons in the fire, so to speak, to try and feel a little less atomized in my community directly. Hopefully I'll have good news on that front sooner rather than later. Okay, on to the guts of today's episode. Hey, listeners, you may or may not know this, especially if you too are feeling atomized or isolated like I was doing last week, but you have a sphere of influence, and it is probably larger than you realize. You have circles of friends and family, or people with whom you interact on a weekly basis. I guarantee it. Even if you don't necessarily know those people very well, you are an influence on them. You can have an effect on the moments in their day when you are with them. Some of you, and I'm speaking directly to Sandy here, have had an immeasurable impact on your community through your volunteerism, your willingness to step up and do difficult, often thankless jobs, and also through the institutions that you have created, which give safe haven to weirdos and oddballs and artists and characters who may otherwise have been never found a home, so to speak. One of the spheres of influence that we all have in common, depending on your situation, is our job, our place of work. So I was let go from my last retail job back in late 2017. September 17th, 2017 was my last day, which I will never forget because it was in a lot of ways my day of liberation. Since then, I've been lucky enough to be able to meet my financial obligations through freelance work alone. I sacrificed, you know, a certain amount of stability and safety, you know, and a regular paycheck for enhanced personal freedom. And I can say that I am extremely lucky. You know, nothing I personally did made this career possible for me. Because the skills I have and the technology to which I have access were all made possible basically through absolute luck alone. Anyone could do what I do if they just had the means to learn the tech and apply that knowledge. That's really it. But anyway, yeah, I should really absolutely do a show about the birth lottery at some point, because it's another facet of this incredibly rigged system. But right now, I want to speak to the experience of my retail workers out there, my office drones, my call center soldiers, my rank and file American worker. You have a powerful sphere of influence that you can leverage subtly to to improve the daily lives of everyone with whom you work. Whether you like them or not, you can improve their day. And I'm not talking about your bosses, right? I'm maybe talking about some of your managers, but probably not most of them if they have higher firepower. And I'm not talking about the CEOs, all right? Most of them, they're just doing fine, and they do not need your help. No, I'm talking about the people in the cubes next to you, or if the company for which you work has recently moved to a new open office layout, I'm talking about the people surrounding you, staring at their screens, struggling right alongside you. You can help them, and immediately in so doing, you can help yourself. The fight is real, and the tactics are effective, but it's a subtle dance that will need to take practice. And what's more, it's going to take kind of a relearning of sorts, because you and me and all of us have been indoctrinated into a sort of overarching church of a kind that we never consented to joining, by the way. The topic of today's show is a single word that has been utterly and cruelly misdefined online. What started as a very real tactic for improving workers' daily conditions has been co-opted to defang it, right? Let's not let that happen. Let's take this word back for our own sakes, to defend ourselves and each other in our places of work and toil. Let's take this word back together. Today's show is all about slacktivism. Slacktivism, a proud and time-honored tradition that should be enthusiastically employed as a tactic, again, of self-defense and self-preservation in all places of work all over the world. Public discourse on Facebook and similar social media platforms would have you thinking that slacktivism is one thing that it is assuredly not. They'll tell you that slacktivism refers to the apathetic kind of activism that people engage in online, like just reposting an article that they read, you know, about the Rwandan genocide or something like that, and then feeling really good about themselves for posting it. That is definitely a social phenomenon. But when I see that, I recognize that as a symptom of people desperately wanting to help, to do some good in this world where they feel utterly powerless to actually affect real positive change. Every time I see a post like that, I don't sigh and roll my eyes, you know, or feel pity for that person, like, oh, they think they're helping. I see someone who wants to change the world for the better and who feels small in the face of the mountainous issues which face the whole of the human family. And they want to do something about it, but their hands are somewhat tied. So they do what they can to at least make their friends and family aware of, you know, X, Y, or Z problem. And there's absolutely nothing wrong about that. So stop shaming people for wanting to help in any little way that they can. And that's not what slacktivism actually is anyway. Let's learn today about slacktivist tactics, how to employ them every day of your working week, and how to celebrate them all year long. So first and foremost, there's a term that I haven't really spent a lot of time using on this show, which I feel has been sorely lacking. I use the term structural violence a lot, and it's kind of the overarching theme of the whole show and kind of my whole philosophy. You know, how do we limit the effects of and eventually work towards the elimination of structural violence? But I haven't really mentioned one of the key sources of structural violence in our society and the world as a whole. That source is class war. And you'll hear pundits on the right using the term class war sometimes, usually in some sort of future tense. They'll say that, you know, the left wants to start a class war. And what they're not mentioning is the blatant fact that a class war has been raging basically forever, and we're all part of it, whether or not you want to accept that fact. The goals of the capitalist owner class and the means by which they seek to attain those goals are inherently at direct odds with the goals of the worker and the worker's means by which to attain their goals. And if I want to really do it justice, I should do a whole episode on class war, so that I can explain that a little better. But suffice it to say that your boss, you know, your employer, the owners of your company do not have your best interests at heart. And that's not because they're bad people. That's not what I'm saying. I'm never going to say that. It is specifically and literally because of the institutions and the structures in place which are currently struggling to support this inherently self-destructive capitalist system. Because of that, the relationship between you and your employer is inherently coercive, unfair, and unjust. So let me ask you a question. How much work do you do at your job? While you're thinking about that, do you ever feel as though you're actually doing the job of multiple people? Or at least that the tasks which you are expected to, you know, engage in and complete in your typical work week should be delegated to more people than just you? Well, that's because you are doing the job of multiple people. There are only so many ways that the business for which you work can increase its profits based on the finite world that we live in and that they're operating in. They could increase the cost of the product that they're selling. But if they did that, then they risk losing market share to their competition. And that is not an acceptable risk for them in a world where the bottom line is the most important thing. Conversely, they could try lowering the cost of their product on the market and hope that an increase in sales will make up the difference in the loss of profits. But there are fixed costs that go into their everyday production in the forms of overhead. So the quickest and the easiest way for a business to improve profits is to squeeze further labor value out of their employees. Marx's labor theory of value dictates that the value of any product can only be equivalent to the labor that it took to make it. Your employer can immediately increase their profits by getting more labor out of you and your coworkers. And the easiest way to do that is to lay people off, or, because layoffs look bad, the other way to achieve that is to not hire people in the first place and to shift those responsibilities to existing positions or build those responsibilities into new positions that they're hiring for. So in the year that I worked my last retail job, this happened multiple times, all right? I only worked there for a year, and this happened on multiple occasions. The one that's easiest to recount, when I first started working there, the company had a dedicated call center to receive calls and to make calls about deliveries and, you know, to generally deal with customers over the phone. And it was an incredibly stressful job because customers can be terrible people sometimes. And when I say call center, I should clarify, it was one woman, this one very nice woman who had a nice speaking voice on the phone, had to deal with all of the, both the, you know, the appreciative customers, the neutral customers, and then obviously the, you know, the livid customers. So it was an incredibly stressful job. And eventually she found employment elsewhere. So instead of hiring a new person to fill that role, to make these hundreds of calls a day and to receive these hundreds of calls a day, the company just shifted the responsibility to us, to me, the level of employee that I was. So we were expected to be available on this terrible, buggy, awful voice over IP system to field incoming calls and to make delivery calls and follow-up calls and scheduling calls and all that stuff while still doing all of our other jobs, which, if you remember when I was talking about it a few episodes ago, were extremely and bafflingly complicated for some reason. Like, I've still no understanding of why in the world our job was so complicated. But I kind of answered my own question. Because they were shifting responsibility more and more to lower their overhead, to lower the costs, the profits that they would lose to paying, right? Their employees. There was nobody who was more overworked than my managers, however, like the managers that were just above me. So not only did they have to do exactly the same job that I did, that was one of their responsibilities, which is primarily just sales. They also had to do manufacturing work. They had to build products. They had hundreds of reports to fill out. Just these insane reports, along with weekly inventory, meetings, countless meetings. They were some of the most stressed human beings I'd ever seen in my entire life. And I remember one day when I was working late, it was just me and one of my managers, and I could tell that he was essentially defeated, you know, on that day, and his defenses were super down. And so I asked what in the world he was even working on at the moment, because it was one of those precious lapses when we weren't working. And he showed me some top secret information that I wasn't supposed to see, and that showed what the stockholders expected the company to be earning in the form of profit that year. And it absolutely blew me away when I saw these secret charts and graphs. So the stockholders were expecting profits of $1.5 million for the year of 2017. And it's pertinent information that the company had never gotten even close to $1 million. And I know that because we had a company-wide initiative the year before to get to $1 million for the first time. And at the end of that year, we missed it by about $200,000. So based on that failure, the stockholders had decided that the new goal ought to be $1.5 million. Because they're not operating in a world of reality, right? The burden of sales, the burden of that goal was put directly on the shoulders of those middle managers and, of course, us, the rank and file, because the workers of a company create all the value that company generates. You create all the value for your company, all of it. Then the capitalists who own the company steal your labor value in the form of profit. And then it pays you as little as it possibly can in the form of wages and salary. Part of the class war that you are engaged in, that all workers are engaged in, is the simple mathematical truth that profits are the theft of the excess labor value you create for the company that you work for. You produce wealth that you do not get to reap the benefits of. Value. You make it. They take it. So, how do you fight back? Well, work like Sabo Tabby, the mascot of the industrial workers of the world, and slack off. What are some ways that you can incorporate slacktivism into your daily work week grind? Let's take a look at the Workplace Partisans Pledge. Until the last capitalist has been overthrown and the means of production has been seized by we, the exploited workers of the world, I pledge to support my fellow workers and to fight capitalism at every opportunity, to decrease the value of stolen labor of my capitalist oppressors, and to make my first priority the happiness and well-being of myself and my fellow workers to the detriment of company profits and management demands. So here are some great tools of slacktivism that you can engage in today. Number one, don't work too hard. Don't ever go that extra step or put in extra work. You are not being fairly compensated for your time. Your job will never actually pay you the value of your labor hours. It won't, because that's the profits that they reap. So don't give them even more free labor. They don't deserve it. Clock out as soon as you possibly can. However, always make it look like you are going that extra mile, especially when you aren't. All right. Number two, don't be a snitch. If you see other coworkers, for example, slacking off or just doing a bad job, you know, don't tell your manager or your boss. If you see someone, you know, quote unquote, stealing their labor hours, you know, don't tattle on them. It's not your job to protect your company. You're not getting paid enough to do so. In fact, number three, conceal the terrible work habits of your coworkers. If they're doing a really terrible, inefficient job, protect them and hide that fact. Keep them safe and secure as you would wish to be kept safe. Now, if the, you know, if the terrible job they're doing is making your life a living hell, then again, protect yourself, you know, keep yourself safe. Number four, don't ever concern yourself with anything that hinders the profits of the company for which you work. You're not getting fairly paid. It's none of your business. Five, additionally, if your company is really especially bad, then deliberately slowing down and sabotaging their profits is actually an act of courage and self-defense. Six, I think. If the customers you serve are directly in the capitalist class, don't go out of your way to serve them. Never view yourself as a servant. And if you make commission from like sales in your job and you're serving the capitalist class, then squeeze as much as you possibly can out of your customers. Number seven, conversely, if your customers are part of the working class, use all of the tools at your disposal in your place of work to get them the best deals you possibly can, to the detriment of your company's profits. Put your customers, your working class customers' needs above the company's needs at all times. And be honest with them if you think that they're getting a raw deal. I think this is number eight. Unless you think that you would actually have a good time, do not go on mandatory company events or outings, especially if they're on your day off. Do not let your workplace infiltrate your already dwindling free time. And there are other forms of slacktivism that I would like to recommend, but I'm not allowed to tell you to do anything illegal. Oh, but hang on. Lots of times, if there's anything useful that your company gives away for free, you know, to your average customer or potential customer, give away a lot of that thing if your customers are working class, and then take them yourself. I mean, it's free, right? So why not? So obviously, all of these tactics come with a caveat. Don't do anything that will endanger your position or that of a fellow worker. You don't want to get fired and you don't want to get anyone else fired. Like I said before, don't protect anyone that is making your life super difficult. You know, you need to take care and you need to protect yourself. Slacktivism is a tenuous dance, kind of, between you and your employer. Because you want to do the least possible amount of work while not getting fired, and they want to squeeze as much labor value out of you as possible without killing you. Although, well, we'll talk a little about that. Also, these tactics are not necessarily applicable to literally every single job everywhere. Slacktivism works really best if you're like an hourly worker, or you're a freelancer, or you're a contractor, you know, who's just generally paid way less than the value of your labor. If you're salaried, you know, and just overworked endlessly. If the business that you work for is especially parasitic, or is, you know, literally and directly harmful to society as a whole or the environment, you know. If your place of work is unsafe or dangerous, if your managers and bosses are cruel and abusive, or if you recognize just inherently that your job and your place of work is inherently exploitative, then absolutely engage in slacktivism. You can really help yourself, you can help your coworkers, and generally you can help the world as a whole. Maybe don't engage in slacktivism if you work for a nonprofit that is actually really helping disenfranchised people, you know, or in an at-risk population. Now, but mind you, take care, because many, many quote-unquote nonprofit organizations are really just huge Leviathan for-profit corporations in sheep's clothing, you know, just in disguise. I can name a few in Milwaukee that purport to do a good job and, you know, are just reaping vast profits for their board of directors. If you can help a fellow human being who is struggling, do so. But never help the capitalist class. That is not your job, to help any CEO get a new, you know, Maserati or a second home. And then equally so, if at your place of work you belong to a really good, functional, well-organized union, then you'll be able to work within that structure to barter for better working conditions. And so slacktivism may not really be necessary for you. But, you know, contradictory, if you work for a place that forces you into a union and it's a parasitic entity in and of itself and it gives you really no protections and just takes dues, slacktivism might be really good for you. If you work for and belong to a cooperative, for example, and you actually own the means of your production, then slacktivism probably isn't necessary because you may actually be getting the full value of your labor. So as always, the circumstances of your resistance will vary according to your experience and your situation. Never make the mistake that your boss cares about you, unless you're actually friends and family with them, you know, outside of the work environment. If you feel underpaid, undervalued, and overworked, I encourage you to engage in slacktivism. Before I go, I would really like to address the fact that this kind of thing is really difficult for a lot of people to consider, because as sociable, creative, curious animals, we really like accomplishing things, you know? We like doing work that's meaningful, and we take pride in work that we can see has a measurable value to the world around us. And the very fact that we are working these pointless, soul-sucking jobs is really nothing more than just a damning criticism of the capitalist system. Because work is not bad. Jobs are. If we were finally freed to do meaningful work that needs doing, you know, we're allowed to self-organize to the betterment of the world, then work would actually be closer to play and flow. And until we get there, slack off as much as you possibly can. Thanks for tuning into The Anti here on WXRW. I've been NTSC, your host, and I'll be back again next week to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti. Bye.